Welcome to the new All In Foods podcast from the Food Decisions Research Laboratory. Food is a defining element of our existence. Gaining a deeper understanding of what food means to us as individuals can help inform us and create empathy and appreciation for one another. This is All In Foods.
Hi, my name is Amit Sharma at the All In Foods Studios of the Food Decisions Research Laboratory at Penn State's School of Hospitality Management. Welcome to this podcast from University Park, Pennsylvania, in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. As per our mission to inform, communicate, and educate each other to make better food decisions, I hope today's podcast will guide us all to make more informed food choices as we deal with this crisis today and in the future. Sustainable Development Goal number 3, Good Health and Well-being, and Sustainable Development Goal number 12, Responsible Consumption and Production, appear to be the most appropriate for our podcast as we respond to the reliable information needs during this crisis. In this podcast, I'm here to talk to my colleagues here at Penn State University, Dr. Bhushan Jairao and Dr. Suresh Kuchipudi. Dr. Jairao is professor in the Department of Veterinary and Biomedical Sciences in the College of Agricultural Sciences at Penn State University. He's also the director of the Animal Diagnostic Laboratory. ADL is one of three such laboratories in Pennsylvania that focus on safeguarding animal and human health and facilitating animal agriculture. Dr. Kuchipudi is clinical professor and head of the microbiology section and associate director of the Animal Diagnostic Lab. His work focuses on the development of novel diagnostic tools and intervention therapies for endemic and emerging viral diseases of animal and humans. Welcome to you both, Dr. Jairao and Dr. Kuchipudi. Welcome to our show.
Thanks, Amit.
Thanks, Amit. Appreciate it.
Yep. So we actually recently recorded a podcast on food safety during the COVID crisis. Therefore, I'm not going to cover too much on what we already have talked about when it comes to food safety. I think it'll be more interesting to dig a little deeper with both of you and given your expertise in this area. So I'm going to first start with you, Suresh. First, can you tell us a little bit about your own research as it relates to the coronavirus?
Sure. So Amit, I'm a virologist by training. So my research lab has a primary focus to study a group of viruses called as zoonotic viruses. So meaning that these viruses transmit from animals to humans. And we focus on several important aspects of these viruses to understand how they transmit and especially how they make people sick. An important question sometimes is why someone gets ill, and the mechanism helps us to really understand the pathogenesis, meaning how the disease is developed. And that knowledge helps us to develop intervention therapies. In addition to that, we also focus on developing better diagnostic tools and therapeutics. We focused on several such important viruses like influenza, Zika virus, and currently after the COVID-19 virus, the SARS coronavirus 2 emerged. We are currently focusing on developing therapeutics using repurposing of FDA-approved drugs.
Interesting. So you already kind of mentioned this. One of the things that we're hearing is that the COVID-19, the virus that causes COVID-19, has its origins in animals, or it's an animal origins. Can you just describe that a little bit more and what it means?
Certainly. So one thing that I wanted to clarify is that there are coronaviruses. So coronaviruses are a group of viruses. It's not just one, many of them. And they have, based on the studies that we know currently, it is believed that these viruses have evolved for over 50,000 years to virtually adapt in most animals and birds, including humans. So they're already there and they continue to be there. And also there are endemic coronaviruses, meaning they're always circulating in human population that makes us mildly sick. This is like a very common cold type coronaviruses. So those are already there. And they, in addition to that, periodically you see that some of these coronaviruses, they evolve and jump out of animal reservoir and learn to infect people and then start spreading. And that's when an epidemic happens, and the epidemic can expand to become a pandemic. So what we have now is something very similar. And the reason that we do understand a fair amount of this process is because this is the third time a coronavirus has caused an epidemic in the 21st century.
That's fascinating in the sense that it also gets us to what you just talked about. I'm going to be on very thin ice with my knowledge of microbiology, but just in fact, listening to one of your interviews online, you mentioned something called a zoonotic spillover event. Can you please explain a little bit what that means, and particularly in that current context?
Certainly. So, first, we need to understand why the viruses evolve so frequently than other pathogens like bacteria. The fundamental nature of some of the viruses that has their genetic code written on RNA, they're inherently error prone. Every time they replicate, meaning they make their babies, they have to copy their genetic code. And in the process, they make mistakes, which are scientifically called as mutations. So these mutations are constantly, or over a period of time, continue to accumulate. So now think about the coronaviruses, as I mentioned. So in animals, for example, animal reservoirs like bats or rodents, they have, based on what we understand today, hundreds of different coronaviruses that somehow learn to coexist with these animals. So they have a kind of association with these animals, and they replicate. And what happens is, over a long period of time, these coronaviruses in wild reservoir like bats or rodents, they are accumulating these mistakes, also called as mutations. And at some point, they have all these accumulated changes have given the virus an ability to suddenly start infecting a completely different host. And that can be an animal or a human being. And the main thing that we need to understand is that the virus has no brain. And perhaps the virus has absolutely no clue that this is happening, because these changes are completely random. And now you asked about the spillover event. So what happens is, if the viruses in a wild animal reservoir like bat, for instance, if they are accumulating these changes, then they need an opportunity to jump, right? So the animal interaction, so wild animals and domestic animals interacting, gives this the opportunity for these viruses at some point when they gain the ability to jump species, then start infecting a completely different host. And that can happen anywhere, anytime, and there is absolutely no way that we can predict exactly when and where it happens. We know how it happens, but we can't really predict when and where it happens.
So one of the reasons I asked you about the spillover event is that there is this common understanding that someone ate something and that had this sort of a spread. So the way you are explaining the spillover event, it is not restricted to just consuming the animal. It can simply be in any kind of interaction. Am I understanding this correctly?
I think you make a very good point, Amit. So the thing is that we need to understand there are two aspects to it. One thing is, because of genetic changes accumulating over a long period of time, there is a virus that is sufficiently changed and has learned the ability to infect people. And that is the first prerequisite. And the second question is, how do people get it? And you could get it by many different ways. You don't always have to eat something. And this can be any different means where humans are interacting with these animals. Because before you interact them, there has to be a prerequisite, which is the virus has changed and it is able to infect people. And then the transmission happens. So it could be butchering animals for meat purposes, or you're handling animals, or you're doing anything. And all of those different aspects can play a role.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, you keep hearing on the news, you know, that people are, you know, it's easy to play the blame game that, oh, that person did this and therefore it happened. And so there's this common understanding that, oh, someone ate something. And so whether it's a soup or whatever that might be, but I think that's really important to know. We usually take a short pause in between here for our listeners. I have a little quiz question. So the question for our listeners is that by now we all know what COVID-19 is and what caused it was a virus. Do you know the name of the virus that caused the COVID-19? And I will share the answer at the end of the podcast. So Bhushan, turning to you with a couple of questions. One of the causes, as Suresh was talking about, is this zoonotic spillover events. And it seems to be caused by environmental impacts of agriculture. Can you explain a little bit about what that means?
So what I'll do here is kind of set the stage and kind of explain you how does the spillover occur. So how does the transitions occur? We need to have a better appreciation of that. So if you really look, we can divide the whole picture into three different parts or three different stages. The first stage is what we call as the preeminent stage or the pre-emergent stage, okay, before the emergence occurs. So in this particular situation, the pathogen, the likely pandemic pathogen, is still in its reservoir, okay? Mm-hmm. And then when it starts expanding within that given sphere of activity, say from a bat to another species and back and forth, so that's where it gets the opportunity for it to become better, more fitter in nature, able to survive, able to adapt within host given within its circumstances. Mm-hmm. So that's the first concept. And what Suresh rightly said is we don't know how long does it take. Does it take 1,000 years, 10,000 years, 5,000 years, or 100 years? We don't know. Mm-hmm. So this pre-emergent stage is something which we are still wrapping our arms around to figure out what it is. Mm-hmm. And then finally, it comes to what we call as the tipping point here. When the pathogen load is so very high, it is so very aggressive, and it has almost infected 90 to 95% of its own species, it is now looking for some other host where it can transfer. And that's when we call as a spillover. And this other host, which is naive, which has never been exposed, comes in very close contact and then has the conditions that favor the transfer and acceptance by the new host, okay? So that's what we call as the pre-emergent stage. The next stage is where we call as the localized emergence. Now, the localized emergence is largely determined by several different factors, such as change in the ecological niche, change in biodiversity, change in practices, expansion of human interactions between the environment, the wildlife, the people around, that gives it better opportunity to become more better and fitter in order to survive in these biodiverse systems. So that is where we call as the stage for local emergence. And then once it finds a human as a host, and it is able to effectively transmit between human to human, not requiring any other host as an intermediate, that's where we find, if it becomes very efficient in transferring from human to human, that's where we call as the full pandemic emergence. And that's where we are at this point in time with the coronavirus, which Suresh talked about.
Interesting.
So the pre-emergence, the local emergence, and then finally the pandemic. Mm. So we have finished the first two stages a long time ago. Mm. The first stage, when was it done? We don't really know. We know for sure the second stage did occur, and it's likely we can put a kind of a placeholder somewhere it occurred in so-and-so place in so-and-so time. And we definitely know when it moved into becoming a pandemic.
Mm. Okay. So how does it interact with agriculture, or does it?
So if we go back and look at the whole concept, what is it that favors the emergence of these organisms from the first stage to the second stage to the third stage? As it was mentioned earlier, we don't really know the first stage. So we are just grasping our hands to figure that out. But if you go back and look since the 1950s or the end of Second World War, what we are looking at is the ongoing expansion of human settlements. Okay, and also the crop and animal agriculture is also, operations are also expanding. And they are going into geographical areas that were very stable in nature. For example, wooded areas and forests were taken over to expand housing, housing people and then agriculture. So stable ecosystems we have kind of taken away. As a result, what has happened is we have now developed rather large, complex and unstable ecozones. They're fairly unstable as such. The stability has changed. So when you change the stability, what happens? It allows different species from different habitats to interact.
Interesting.
Okay. So when these vertebrates and invertebrates, now I'm talking two different aspects, vertebrates and invertebrates, mm-hmm. start interacting in this rather large ecological zone, which is unstable, trying to stabilize itself with the new perturbations that have taken place between animals, humans, wildlife coming in. The pathogen, the likely pandemic pathogen is an active search mode, looking for something. Mm-hmm. Where can I keep on expanding? Where can I become more better and fitter in survival? Mm. And that's the point in time where we see, as Suresh mentioned, spillover. That's the key word is spillover. Mm. So the spillover takes place, and then the kind of stabilization in the new host in humans is, that's what we are really concerned about, is changing of an ecological system into an ecological zone that becomes unstable, favoring the likely pandemic pathogen to establish itself and become more suited to transfer effectively from human to human.
It's very interesting. Just as you said about these unstable zones, if you want to call it, do you think there could be any impetus to change in the way we do agriculture, or in ways that we can prevent such zones to, or creation of these zones? Do you think this current pandemic gives us any kind of ways to move forward? And if there are, what might be sort of the easy ones to do?
So one of the first and the foremost things which people have been talking right from, I would say, the first avian influenza outbreak that we really were fearing in 2001, 2002, and then the 2009 one, and then the SARS and the MERS that came in. Consistently, I would say in the last 20 years, the people in the area of public health are constantly wooing the politicians and the rest of the system, please develop a global surveillance program. A global surveillance program that's just not humans, mm-hmm. just not animals, but include wildlife. So include all of these three spheres and develop a very robust surveillance system that just not is focused on the developed countries, but the developing and the underdeveloped countries too. Mm-hmm. A very strong surveillance program. It may be initially very expensive, but in the long term, it pays out for itself. Okay, mm-hmm. We can reduce so that we detect a likely pandemic pathogen well early on and prevent its disastrous effects, economic effects on human health and animal health effects down the road. So if we invest in a strong surveillance system, I think we have answered a significant portion. It's not the end of all, but mm-hmm. that would be the first stone that you need to really lay is good surveillance. We have the technologies, and Suresh will tell you, there are diagnostic systems, there are mechanisms that we can do testing right at the place where you are. If you're in a rainforest and you're looking for a pathogen, you have the systems that can be deployed so very close to those areas to do those surveillance programs. Mm. We are that close. Not only do the surveillance, but intimate the world in rest in minutes. Mm. Okay. So we have those capabilities and technology. It's only that what we need is the appetite, the global appetite to recognize the fact that global surveillance mechanisms are absolutely critical at this stage. And whatever may come, yes, we may develop the vaccines, we may develop the drugs, but before we can develop the vaccine, the drugs, we need to know what's there. Mm. What is going on? What is circulating? What is emerging? And surveillance programs is the key to the entire a gamut of different procedures and protocols that that we will plan to put in place to address the next pandemic. And people have said this on and on, on and on, on and on. Mm. I think a point as time we have come is we have to invest in these resources. It's not that people are not doing. WHO does on its own. Every country does on its own. But we need to bring our forces together on a common platform and start addressing it.
Suresh, could you give an example of the kind of surveillance system that Bhushan was talking about that might be sort of close to an agriculture, sort of food and agriculture aspect of human life, if you want to call it?
I think the key, as Bhushan mentioned, Amit, is these are done rather disjointedly. So there is a animal health surveillance that happens at national level. And in many countries, a system such as what exists in the US may not really, not even a rudimentary stage is present. So first thing is to make sure we have a proper surveillance in most part of the world. And we know that there are certain parts of the world that are much more likely to support the emergence of pathogen. We call them as the hot spots because of the social, economic and geographic conditions. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, the concept of One Health, Bhushan has been championing this. Mm-hmm. The main thing is now it is increasingly being recognized that animal health do not, or human health, they don't operate in isolation. You have to really zip up these networks. And what should happen is there should be a mechanism of a concerted animal and human surveillance that is global and that is connected. So we are constantly monitoring and the emergence of these viruses. So what it can help us do is, it's almost like if you think about a weather forecast. So you are watching over them and you see, I see a virus that is picking up mutations that might give it an edge in human population. So you are following them. And while you can't stop them, but what you can do is we can prepare the tools ahead of the time. For instance, now, after the pandemic was well underway, we're still scrambling to develop a diagnostic assay. But if you have these mechanisms and you knew that these are my top list of potential pandemic viruses, then we can proactively prepare diagnostic tools and vaccines ahead of the time. That is a major advantage. And if I may also go back a step and answer the question on agriculture that you brought up, Amit. The main thing is, as you mentioned, there is this challenge between growing world population and trying to feed the global population, the so-called food security, and then the challenge of impact on environment. So clearly, we can't go back and undo the expansion of cities and using the land for farming and so on. Looks like you're frozen. Are we still there?
Amit?
Bhushan, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah, looks like Amit's screen has frozen. Should I continue or wait?
I think let him come back live.
Yeah.
Or his bike life.
Could you start that part again and we'll collapse it. Thank you.
Okay, so there is this global challenge of meeting the needs of growing world population and ensure food security of all people while having a sustainable method where the impacts on environment is minimized. And as we said earlier, the population shifts and growing world population, increasingly we have to use the land for human food production, both animal production as well as crops. And that is taking away the forests and the wild animals' habits is threatened. But there are mechanisms where we can maximize the productivity so the land use can be minimized. That is one option. And the other major thing that can be addressed is in many parts of the world, especially the rural and poorer countries like Asia and Africa, there is this subsistence agriculture. So people are having a small holding of a few animals in their houses where they're constantly interacting. But the key challenge is that these animals do not have or have no access to any kind of veterinary care. So meaning they are very burdened with endemic diseases. So that is one thing that we can also address is these farming systems can be improved by providing them some mechanism of healthcare or generating better disease-resistant animals or high-producing animals. So the subsistence agriculture is one other source of constant animal-human interactions, both wild and domestic animals. And that is one thing that can be addressed from an agricultural standpoint. And the second and the other most important thing is where this produce is actually sold or where it is butchered. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. one of the major challenging aspects of this whole process of pathogen emergence is the live animal markets in Asia and Africa that are extremely popular. And the challenge is that these create crowded conditions of different species of animals. And from a virology standpoint, if you look at that, and that is the perfect recipe for a virus to jump. So you have in the same place, a bunch of chicken, ducks, and different animals and humans all are interacting. And any virus that has made some mistakes and now is finding a unique opportunity to jump into a duck or jump into a whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that is one thing that the world need to remind and wake up perhaps and say, can we create mechanisms in these places for slaughtering these animals in a place where it is not accessible to humans? So that risk can be significantly minimized or mitigated. So those are still sustaining the food production, but there are mechanisms and smart ways where we can reduce the impact and perhaps slow down the pathogen emergence.
It's interesting you said that, you know, I think you said you need to wake up to some of these realities. And I was thinking that maybe from a food safety point of view, we sort of slept on the wheel on this one. But if, and you both have already spoken to this, so Suresh, I'm going to ask you first. If you were to put on your look into your crystal ball, what do you think might be, broadly speaking, might be an important impact of this pandemic on food and agriculture, just broadly speaking, around the globe? What do you think one most important outcome that might happen? And then Bhushan, I'll ask you as well the same thing.
So clearly, I hope that this pandemic certainly has reminded all of us to think about this concept of One Health and how do we manage the providing enough food or securing food for the growing human population, but come up with ways where we minimize the impact. So I hope that this pandemic would lead to some kind of concerted efforts to more sustainable agriculture. So that can focus on how do we reduce the disease burden of animals, and then how do we detect them or provide these resources in places where they don't exist? Mm-hmm. And also the other important aspect is how do we minimize the land usage or increase the productivity of the crops and animals. I think that is one, certainly a big discussion that should happen, and that may have a lasting impact on the agriculture, both animal and crop-based agriculture.
Thank you, Suresh. Bhushan, what do you think?
So from where I come to look at this, Amit, is I think we need to start planning this at a global level. Starting from local level to global level, we need to start creating these different spheres of interactions to a global level that is an independent entity that has got the finance, that has got the resources, that is able to go not only and predict what's likely to happen, but also warn the other countries, what do you need to be prepared for? Yes, this is occurring, say, in India, but what is it that the US and other countries have to be ready in advance? Diagnostic kits, what is the likelihood? And we are very good in planning, but the only thing is we kind of sit on the wall to say, oh, it's not going to come into our country, or we have ways and mechanisms that, you know, we will delay the process. Instead of doing that, yes, invest in resources, in diagnostic kits, look well into advance of making therapeutics, as Suresh has earlier pointed out in his talk, is something as an independent entity that is by itself, comprising just not of human health, but veterinary health and environmental health people, all looking towards is the first stone that is going to be laid is global surveillance plus planning in each of the respective geographic areas, because each of the geographic areas may have similarities. For example, Southeast Asia, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam may have a particular set of ways of doing things, which is fairly common in terms of public health. Whereas the US may have something different as comparable to Canada, but less that of South America. So each one of us have our own ways of dealing with public health issues. And that would give us time to be prepared, or give us the lead time. What we call in epidemiology is you get the lead time. So that's what we are really looking for now, is we recognize pandemics are going to come. This is not the first and the last.
Yeah, I guess.
Hope not.
Yeah.
Hope well, not. But we need an independent agency that has got the power, the resources to motivate and bring other countries to think, folks, this is just not an outbreak in some place.
Yeah.
This is going to affect us. Let's get together and put it out at its source where possible. I think that should be the attitude.
Very interesting. Thank you both for taking us a little deeper into these issues. And I guess our work is cut out even after all of this, and hopefully soon that this gets into control, right? And thank you both for being on the forefront of taking care of things. We really appreciate that. Thanks for joining us again. And I'm sure our audience got a lot out of this.
Yeah, again, I just want to say thanks, Amit, for doing this. And this is really important that people need to understand the big picture. And also, I think your focus of tying this pandemic to the food production systems and sustainability and global food safety and security, I think it's really an important question that we all should be addressing now. So thanks for doing this.
Same here, Amit. Thank you so much for bringing us on. Although we are veterinarians by training, but we kind of stepped out beyond our bounds. Although we deal with coronaviruses, it's not that we don't deal, but this is something that has brought us into the forefront and looking from beyond our area of activity and trying to see how well we can bridge and bring this issue to the public. And thank you for that opportunity.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for giving this really important perspective. And before we leave, the answer to my question is, the name of the virus that has caused the COVID-19 pandemic is called the Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome Coronavirus 2, or SARS-CoV or CoV-2. It was previously known as the 2019 novel coronavirus. The disease caused by this virus is called, you guessed it, coronavirus disease or COVID-19. The term virus actually comes from the Latin word for poison or slimy liquid. Viruses in general are neither considered dead nor alive. Viruses are not alive as they do not have cells, and so they cannot turn food into energy. And without a host, they are just a pack of chemicals. But at the same time, viruses are not exactly dead, as they do have genes and they do reproduce, which we all painfully are aware of. Well, that's about the length of my knowledge of microbiology. And to our audience, always make safe and informed food choices. Above all, please stay healthy and cheerful as we fight our way back through this pandemic. Until next time, from the All In Food Studios, this is Amit Sharma. Thank you for listening.